So I'm so excited to sit down tonight with Stephen and Adam as part of a new series that Adam is undertaking, and I am so honored that Adam asked me to be part of this conversation. Very cool conversation. So Adam, can you tell me a little bit more about this audio project that you're undertaking?
So my background is that I'm the current president of Blue Max, which is a leather group in St. Louis, and I've been president now for, this is my second year, and earlier this month, June 5th, marked the HIV Long-Term Survivors Awareness Day, and I thought it'd be a good idea to honor them and listen to their story, and it just seemed like a really good fit that it'd be in podcast form. So I invited Stephen over and really excited to hear his story. And yeah.
So yeah, Stephen, so just thanks for joining us. I guess we can start from the top. So tell us a little bit about your childhood. Where did you grow up?
I grew up all over the place. I was born in Cumberland, Maryland, and I have had an older brother, about a year older than me. He was also born in Cumberland, Maryland. But my memory begins, around age 3 or 4, till 1957. We lived in Altoona, Pennsylvania. Altoona was famous for its railroads and coal mining. We stayed there another couple years and moved to West Virginia, which was a totally different culture. The town was only about 10,000 people, and it was a beautiful place. I loved it there. Dad got another promotion, and so I was in the 7th grade, and the public schools in Clarksburg were almost parochial. We changed classes single file, no talking in the halls. The principal stood out in the hall with a whistle and a paddle. If you got out of line or talked, you were at his mercy. So it was very strict. The schools weren't well equipped with equipment, but the teachers were great, I thought. They knew their business, they knew their topics, they knew what they were talking about. And when we first moved to Michigan, it was in Dearborn, and it was a bungalow.
How old were you when you moved?
Well, I was probably, that was January of 63, I think. So I was still about 12 years old, 7th grade. I was young because I started kindergarten early. So I started first grade early. So I was always the young kid in the class. So I stayed there until the end of 11th grade when my dad got another transfer, and so we moved to Lansing, Michigan. Had a great high school, but it wasn't my high school, but I graduated. That was my senior year. That was the only year I spent there. I was accepted at Michigan State, so that's where I went to school in East Lansing, and I stayed at home.
What did you study at Michigan State?
I started out in engineering, but I couldn't hack the calculus and all of that, and I just couldn't get past my high school teacher's explanation of calculus, which made no sense to me whatsoever.
So how did you, what originally led you to major in engineering?
I was romantically in love with boats. I wanted to be a boat builder, ship designer. After I got into college, I tried out for the marching band and was accepted. So that was 68, and that was the last year Michigan State had an all-male marching band, and they were raunchy. Musicians are raunchy people.
We can vote vouch for that.
Yes. Marching drum corps.
So what do you play?
I played the baritone.
Awesome. Okay.
Low brass?
Yep, yeah. Low brass. I was low brass.
So, you were at Michigan State, but then you moved to Minnesota. Minneapolis.
I went to Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, okay.
For a master divinity. Because I ended up majoring in religion at Michigan State. And the reason why they had a religion department is that Michigan State was modeled after the University of Notre Dame de Paris. It wasn't called theology, it was called religion, because we had, we studied various religions, comparative religions, basically. So when I went to the seminary, I thought I was prepared pretty well, but it was pretty different. I found out that a lot of seminary students are raunchy people, too.
More raunchy than musicians?
My musician friends could be pretty raunchy. I was asked to join the music fraternity at Michigan State 2 years in a row, and I turned it down. And the reason, again, was, you know, after 1970, nobody wanted to be part of the establishment, and fraternities were seen as establishment type things. Churches were establishment. Even the university was establishment, even though they allowed, you know, demonstrations and all that kind of thing. Because Lansing next door was also the capital of the state, the demonstrations were kind of mild. The Students for a Democratic Society were going to burn down the ROTC building. Well, they all brought logs or something piled up against the wall, and it was like, that wasn't going to work. Everybody knew it, but it was just the thought that they were going to. And I think they were going to do a march down Grand River to the Capitol in Lansing, but they called out riot police and that, and I saw buses of guardsmen, maybe. They were National Guardsmen. I can't remember exactly, but the same thing we have going on now. But they weren't armed like the police you see now. They didn't have vests. They didn't have shields. They probably had their belly clubs, you know. They probably had their sidearms, but I didn't see rifles or anything like that. Now, remember, just a couple years earlier, half of Detroit was in flames over the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. So to have the demonstrations 2 years later made a lot of legislators nervous. So there was a large crowd control, but it wasn't dogs, it wasn't squirting people with fire hoses or anything like that I remember.
So, is seminary, what kind of transition was that like for you after, you know, being a townie at Michigan State? Like,
I wasn't always a townie at Michigan State. After my first year, my parents moved away. Because Dad got another transfer to Toledo, Ohio. So I had to move into the dorms. I didn't get a wink of sleep. It was always too noisy for me. One thing that I learned later in life was that I had ADHD and was never diagnosed in my childhood, because I was well-behaved, because if I wasn't well-behaved, I'd get a beating when I got home. I got a beating anyway when I got home, but, you know, it was on a daily basis just because. So there was no, those didn't stop until I was almost in my junior year, I guess. Dad was pretty free with his belt, so, on all of us kids. And I think my brother suffered the most. But anyway, so I was well-behaved in class, so it was never diagnosed. And it wasn't diagnosed until real late in life. And I probably would have had better academic success if I had been able to concentrate better. I just didn't have anybody I could tell that to.
So when your parents moved away, was it almost a little bit of a relief, like, to finally be on your own?
Yes and no. My brother also was attending school at the same time. We didn't room together, but he was, you know, around. I saw him. So
there's some support system there?
If you could call it that, yeah. I mean, I wasn't totally alone or abandoned. We'd see each other. So.
What drew you to the seminary school? Because over at least my experience, I've met quite a few gays that started off in seminary school, and then I guess they finally came to terms with themselves, and then ended up leaving for whatever reason.
Well, needless to say, churches are the establishment, and they're not places for change, particularly not in a good way. No, in the sense of, at least in the Protestant area, what they do to people. And you can get into all kinds of theological fights and scraps and everything, but some people are just entrenched in their cognitive biases, and I could preach till I was blue in the face, and I would still hear some of my congregants spout out the same old thing they were thinking before they came through those doors as when they went out. And so it was too frustrating for me. And I was not out. I was undecided. I really didn't know what I was, even though we had a raunchy band at Michigan State. I still was very naive, because I was saving myself for marriage. And I did have a girlfriend my senior year at Michigan State. She was going to school in Ohio, and her father had been my pastor, so I had that connection. And I just thought that we were going to be forever, ever bound together. And she's extremely beautiful. And I don't know what she saw in me, but I think my first year at the seminary, she broke up with me. So I never was interested in anybody else until I met the first Mr. X.
So from seminary, you moved to Minneapolis.
Yeah, I after I quit the seminary, watched all my class graduate, I found a job as a librarian at the Columbus College of Art and Design. I was in charge of circulation and the student help. I got pretty depressed. I was pretty lonely. Didn't have any friends from work or anything. I decided I would go into the computer area. I found a job in computer data entry.
You used a roommate service.
Yes.
To find a roommate. So yeah. Tell us about that.
Oh, it was funny. I needed a place to stay. Even though I made money, but I just didn't have any place to stay. So I said, I need to find a place to live. It was a roommate service. I don't know where I saw it advertised, if it was in the phone book. But it was uptown and a nice area, Minneapolis. And so I made an appointment and went. And, of course, you had to be interviewed. And as he was interviewing me, I didn't act like a gay person. I didn't know anything. I didn't know what gay was. And he said, "You do know that this is a gay roommate service, don't you?" And I said, "No. What's a gay?" I was very naive. Very naive.
Was that just a scary thought that he brought that up?
I think my need to find a place to live was stronger than my fear of who I would be living with. In our conversation and in our interview, he said, "Well, have you ever been to a gay bar?" And I said, "No, what's that?" He said, "It's a bar with gay people." Having been brought up a Methodist, we didn't drink. So I didn't go into bars. And so I didn't know anything about it. But I found out that just across the street from work was a gay bar. And so I thought I would try it. And I thought, well, if I'm killed, I'm killed, you know, because my legs were literally shaking like a leaf. I went there after I worked the second shift, so I got off at 11. And nerdy me was dressed in my work clothes, jacket, shirt, tie, you know, slacks, loafers. But I carried a briefcase with me for some odd reason. I have no, to this day, I don't know what I carried in it.
So how were you dressed compared to everyone else at the bar? Did you feel like you stood out?
I don't know. I wasn't aware of who I was in the presence of others and the atmosphere and all of that. This was the height of disco, and so y'all come back saloon, even though it was cowboy oriented type saloon, was not particularly cowboy. So I walked in the door, and they had set up, they had bleachers. They had bleachers in this place, and then they had a rail blocking off this bleacher that looked like a split log rail. And there was this handsome man sitting on this rail as I came in the door, past the bouncer. I had to show ID and all that. And maybe I dug into the briefcase for that. I don't know, but anyway. This briefcase was sort of my security blanket, I guess. I don't even remember his name. I think his name was Rusty. Very handsome, and he said, hello. I said, oh, hello. And I said, I'll be right back. And I went over to the bar. No, I'm a person that didn't drink. I ran over to the bar, and I ordered the only drink that I knew the name of, which I think was a vodka gimlet, if I remember right, with two hazelnuts in it.
So was that your actual first drink?
Not my actual first drink, but my first drink at a bar.
So was that whole experience just like sensation overload because it was so different than anything?
It was dark. The music was loud. They had, of course, the disco ball and the lights and everything. But I was there a little bit early before the crowds because, you know, it was 11 o'clock. So those people didn't get there till after 11, 11:30. So.
Some things never change.
Yeah, some things. There you go. I came back and I said, hi. And he said, oh, I didn't think you were coming back. And I said, well, why not? I said, I'd be back. He said, well, people say that around here. They don't really mean it. They don't do that. And we hit it off pretty good and stuck around him most of the night. I don't recall if I did any dance. I didn't know how to dance. I was a Methodist, my God. So anyway, the bar closed, I think, at 1:30. And he said, well, there's a party after the bar closes. Do you want to come with me? It's one of my friend's birthdays. And I thought, well, this is new, too. So I said, okay. Because I kind of trusted him by then. I have no idea how I got over there. But anyway, I was there and sitting on the couch with him and with my briefcase. He called himself Greta. This was my first introduction to males using female names. And it was his birthday. And it's his party, and there are all kinds of people there, and dancing in this apartment. There's one particularly tall, tall person who later that night donned of some kind, a fall. It was a braided fall that went all the way down his long back, and his hair was cut shorter than yours, Adam. that was frightening, but he went by a male name. He was Donnie, you know. Greta claims to have written a gossip column when he lived in New York City, and he would gossip about anybody and anything, I guess. He was sort of a shady character, sort of the ringleader of this little group. There were some really nice people in it, but there were some really hardcore people there, too. Donnie was one of them. They were all using she when they were referring to males, and I didn't know who they were talking about because I was looking around for the girls. Silly me.
So were you like doe-eyed the whole night, just like, what is going on around me?
Exactly.
This night of yours opened the door to your new life, basically.
Yeah, like, yeah, I think so. Totally unexpected, and I hate surprises. I really hate surprises, but I was surprised at every corner that night, and I guess learned, you know, subsequently that this was pretty much gay life, which isn't really true. There are a lot of gays who never go to bars. Donnie kind of latched on to me, and I was friends with that group for the longest, longest time. One of the things they did that was a ritual was have dinner together Saturday night before going out to the bar. And then after the bars, they would go to the bathhouse. I guess I had decided that maybe I really was gay.
So a hard step in a lot of people's lives is just kind of turning to themselves and just admitting that, you know, admitting that you are, in fact, gay. Like, mm-hmm. Do you feel like the support group of these friends, these close-knit friends that you've been hanging out with, like, that they just welcomed you in open arms and you just...
They seem to, and I don't know why, but they seem to. The one thing that happened to me from the gay community was that these group, and they were had some very handsome men in there, were educated, you know, artsy, and some of them were basically gangsters, but we all got along and liked each other. And I don't know why they liked me, but then they started to compliment me on how I looked. They told me I was handsome and all that. Well, this was, they were telling this to a person who never got a compliment from anybody in his life as far as his looks go. In fact, I wouldn't even look in the mirror when I was growing up. I just hurried up and washed my face and went on. Didn't want to see myself in the mirror. It was partly from my family background, and they didn't have anything nice to say about me and didn't encourage me and didn't tell me I was handsome, didn't tell me I looked good or anything like that. They were always pointing out something about me that was wrong. So this was my first experience of having anybody really tell me that they thought I looked handsome or anything.
So one thing that I found interesting when we were chatting was that you were able to name down to the day in October in 1980 when you came out. Was that like the day that you came out to your family?
No. Never discussed it in my family. They are, were, are, dad's still alive. My mother died last year. She's 94 and a half. Their mechanism for traveling through life was denial, denial, denial. So that's how they went through life, and they didn't want to know about it. They didn't want to hear about it. Later on, I found out that my brother was gay, and I guess he came out to my parents, and he must have been, maybe he was a sophomore or a junior in college, and they, I don't know, they took him for some kinds of treatments.
Conversion therapy and all that?
I have no idea, but psychiatry and all kinds of things. It's all very hush-hush because you just didn't talk about that stuff.
Did you come out to each other then? Or have a bond after that, I guess?
No. My brother wasn't the bonding type, and especially not with me. Ever since we were little, he had this extreme case of sibling rivalry. It wasn't ever reconciled until maybe a month before he died. He called me and told me that he got a change in his medication. He was on Prozac. I think he'd been on Prozac for 2 weeks, and then he died. So he sounded so different. He sounded so much more mellow, so much more accepting of me, especially. And I was happy for him, and I told him I was. But I don't want to make it sound too sad. I mean, compared to my schoolmates, I was a privileged person.
A lot of people in the community, there's a lot of stories of just like that dealing with family that weren't always accepting, like, doesn't even have to be the gay thing, but just like, you know, just different forms of like mental abuse or whatever, and they ended up going out and seeking their own family. So that group of friends you hung out in Minneapolis, was that kind of like your chosen family of sorts?
Well, I think they chose me more than I chose them. But
whatever works.
But yeah, that was my group of friends. They're the ones who told me who I was. And what they told me was I wanted to reject it, but they wouldn't let me. They said, no, you're a very handsome person. I said, you know, no, I'm not. So I started looking in the mirror. I started washing my face, combing my hair, shaving better. And they taught me about how to look, what to use on my face, what to use on this pimple, what to, you know, what you do with this and what you do with that. So there were a lot of things that I didn't know that I was glad to know. So yeah, I suppose if that was the function of a family, you could call them a family.
So what was the dating scene like?
Cautious, I'd say. It wasn't until, late in 83 that they even discovered what the cause of this mysterious plague was, which was labeled the gay plague, because unfortunately the CDC, The only commonality they had in the reporting of this mysterious disease that took young men's lives was that they were admitted gay men. Young men, not old people like me. They were young.
So when was the first time that you heard of this? Like, how did that happen?
I can't remember exactly when the first time I heard about this mysterious disease was. It was sort of a hush-hush thing in the community. But if you knew somebody who had caught this disease, you were probably suspect, and people kind of avoided you. So I don't think people were really forthright. They didn't come up and say, "Hi, I like you. Do you want to have sex? But by the way, I have this condition." And you have to remember that because they really didn't know for 3 years what caused this thing, that they didn't know how it was transmitted.
Did people even know they were positive, I guess, at that time? Like, did they even know until they got sick?
No. There was no test for it. Mm-hmm. You couldn't test something you didn't know what the cause was. That was a big problem. And so my recollection is that there was a possibility that it would take 3 years for the HIV to progress to the point that it would affect a person, that you could tell that they had the disease. Now, that was in the early stages, the early years. Like today, there was no government guidance. There was no government support. There was a conservative person by the name of Ronald Reagan who had been a movie star. Denial was from the top down. You have to understand that this benefited quote-unquote straight, religious, God-fearing people. That was the type of society that was desired by those in power in the United States at the time. And if this was happening to gays, well, it was God's revenge for them for being so profligate and going against God's laws and everything. And believe me, every politician in that vein has blamed anything, not just politicians, religious fanatics, have blamed gays for anything bad that has happened.
I still see that today, unfortunately.
Nothing has changed, has it?
Nope.
Common knowledge going around then, between 81 and 84, was that this happened to people on either coast of the United States. So you were very careful not to interact with anybody who told you they were from any of the cities on the East Coast or the West Coast.
So that was like a early form of like serosorting?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. Yeah. You know, today's pandemic crisis, they've learned nothing from the AIDS crisis. They've learned nothing at all. We didn't see it back then, but we're seeing it now, that the pharmaceuticals were part of the problem back then, and it's coming to light that they're a problem today, but in a different direction. So what I mean is, there weren't enough people contracting AIDS in the United States for pharmaceuticals to be incentivized to do research on what might be causing it, what might be a treatment, what might be a cure. I guess say in 1984, they didn't know what it was. I mean, they finally determined that it was a virus, and that threw everybody into a panic anyway, so they didn't know how it was transmitted. So it's not until 1 or 2 years later that they announced that, now this is the CDC reporting, that they have not found any reports of people catching HIV through casual contact, through food, through water, or through basically surfaces, air.
You said that was the 1983 timeline?
83 was when they discovered the virus that led to AIDS. There was a supposedly simultaneous discoveries made by a French scientist and an American scientist. And they both claimed to have discovered that it was a virus. Here in the United States, it was labeled human immunodeficiency virus, HIV. But AIDS was the term used, which was acquired immunodeficiency syndrome, was used before the discovery of the virus itself to label this disease.
Do people still label it the gay disease, though?
Yeah, sure. They still think they can catch it from touching, kissing. People are ignorant. They're not ready to educate themselves on anything like this, especially if it has to do with gays or anything like them. Remember, we're still living in a society that wants America to be God-fearing. There's no reason for them to... There's no incentive, I should say, unless a member of their family or a close relative or friend has caught the disease. There's no incentive for anybody to learn anything about it.
So you mentioned that a lot of the hotspots were like on the coastal cities.
Right.
Like being in the Midwest, did you feel somewhat safe?
Yeah, we were made to feel safe here in the Midwest.
Unless it's a long route.
That didn't last very long. No. Because, you know, it didn't take too long before all 50 states and the territories were reporting into the CDC that they had someone in the hospital with AIDS. And again, they didn't know. So one of the things, by 1984, they'd suggested that men having sex with men who had multiple partners were at very high risk for catching HIV. And the advice was to be in a monogamous relationship with whomever you're having sex with. And so that's why I was cruising that night at the Gay 90s for a monogamous partner.
For that night?
Yes.
Because people, what? Do not abstain.
You know, it's easier said than done. Monks go through years of training for abstinence. They just don't jump into it all at once. And it's foolish to expect the general public to abstain from a very strong desire to procreate in however form that takes. I guess maybe after the age of 30, you start to get this feeling, of, like I said, of wanting a nest, wanting a home, wanting to settle down and wanting to have someone you like to grow old with you, and you grow old with them. So that was my goal in 1984 when I was cruising the Gay 90s bar and found Mr. X.
So like cruisy bars were still pretty common and active?
They were, because they just were. Force of habit, call it. Once you're in a groove like that, it's hard to get out. Mm-hmm. I think.
So a lot of younger men were becoming ill, so it's kind of like that old adage that like young people just think they'll never die, so they do whatever they want.
Well, you do, I think that that's true. I think that you just don't think that you're vulnerable. Someone else will get it, but not you. That's the denial part. It can't happen to me kind of an attitude. That happens somewhere else. I think those are the two kind of attitudes that I found. Back then, monogamy became more of the thing to do, at least with some of the older peeps. They settled down more, and with someone. Minneapolis didn't have to close the bathhouses. They just weren't being used anymore. The bars were still open. People still go dancing and everything, but they didn't go there to cruise, unless you were really young and just coming out and wanted to do that. But the older and wiser people just didn't do that. So that was 84, up to 84. That year, Rock Hudson announced he had AIDS. I don't think a lot of people even knew Rock Hudson was gay. Hollywood had kept it quiet because he was always playing a leading man against another woman in the films and in this TV series. So there was no reason to suspect that he was anything other than straight. So he announced that, and he went to France They had a therapy there that was using a type of penicillin we didn't have over here. It wasn't approved by the FDA. Didn't go through clinical random trials or anything like that. But
journalist Daryl Yates Rist just returned from 5 weeks at the Institute, where he reported on hundreds of American AIDS victims who have gone to France for what they cannot get in the U.S.
If you can, theoretically, if you could knock out that virus, if that's really the virus causing AIDS, then you can stop the destruction of the immune system and the immune system will begin to rebuild. What they're using in France is a drug that can inhibit the reproduction of that virus in the blood.
It's unavailable here?
The drug is totally unavailable here.
Then Ronald Reagan decided that he would recall law cuts to the United States. I didn't even know a president could do that to a private citizen.
He was actually required to come back to the States?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I remember the scene they showed it on television.
It seems like it'd be a big step in changing of the tide, I guess, because if he's like a national treasure, like, and if the president literally calls a citizen home, like, you have to acknowledge that what is going on, right?
No, you don't have to acknowledge it, but he just did it, you know. That was the first time, by the way, that I found out that Ronald Reagan ever mentioned AIDS publicly. So that was 3 years after the fact. Well, you can see modern parallels to how denial works. Heroines of that story were Elizabeth Taylor and Whoopi Goldberg. Elizabeth Taylor came right out chastising Ronald Reagan for not helping the gay community, and she stood by the gay community and people with AIDS ever after till her death.
And I thought, I am going to do everything in my living power to get at this disease and kill it by its throat.
She was the only prominent person to speak out at that time. Those two women were brave enough to speak up. And that changed the tide. So I think, if memory serves me right, in the United States, 1986, the FDA approved AZT to go through these randomized clinical trials to see if it was effective against the AIDS virus. It was the only medicine, the only thing. You can only guess. The parallels today of nutty kinds of therapies to try to cure yourself of COVID-19 were just as nutty back then. So I don't know how many people died trying to use these things, but they did. You're desperate. Receiving a diagnosis that you have HIV back then was a death sentence.
When did they finally develop a test for it, so at least people knew?
They developed a test that would test for the antigen bodies in the blood, and they tested the blood. The clinics were, I think, offering the test, but they weren't offering it anonymously. Everybody in the medical field was required to report it, whether you liked it or not.
Wow. So that just added to the discrimination from it?
Oh, yeah, sure. So in April of 87, April 8th, 1987, test results came back that I was positive for HIV. And the next day, a little yellow beat-up car rolled up in my neighborhood across the street, and a woman got out, came to my door and knocked on and said, "I need to know everybody who you've been with." I said, "I'm monogamous. I've only been with one person." She didn't want to accept that. "No, I need to know everybody." I said, "I've only been with one person." She didn't believe that gays could be monogamous.
When you were in the doctor's office hearing that news,
I didn't hear it in the doctor's office.
Oh.
You know how I was told?
Yeah.
One day after work, I told the first Mr. X that I had this terrible stomach ache. I think it's an ulcer, and I need to go to the emergency room. So he took me to the emergency room. The hospital doctor was there, you know, in the emergency. And he said, "Well, I don't think you have an ulcer," and saw my partner there. So he said, have you ever been tested for HIV? And I said, no. No reason for me to get tested, right? I was monogamous. Mr. X wasn't around anymore by the time. He had found somebody else and left to other parts with this person he met in New Orleans. I got the call on the phone. These were the exact words the doctor said. Yes, you have it. That was it. And he said, I don't know how to treat it. Nobody knows, so goodbye.
Jeez.
It wasn't a month after that that I was fired from my job. Somebody from that office called my work because there was no other way they could know. Mm-hmm. Of course, I wasn't fired for being gay, wasn't fired for being HIV positive. I was fired for other reasons that they found. And I was feeling suicidal and everything because, like I said, it was a death sentence and I didn't want to go through what I saw in the pictures and everything. And I did find another doctor who would take care of me, and he said, there, Minneapolis has a test site for a drug called AZT. I can enroll you in it if you would like. It's no guarantee that you'll receive the AZT. You could receive a placebo. I said, well, sure, I have nothing to lose. They were giving me these card capsules were in these pop-out. You had to figure out how to take 15 of these a day over the 24-hour interval. The government kept changing the level of CD4 count that you had to have before you were considered from HIV to AIDS. I was down into the category where they said I had AIDS, and so at that time they gave me the open-label AZT drug. The doctor I had was very, very good to guide me into that protocol. He also guided me to a counselor that helped me quite a bit because, like I said, I was suicidal. I didn't want to go through what I saw. It turned out that I was pretty much asymptomatic, or what they called a slow progressor. I was lucky enough to find another job, and then I finally found another computer operator's job. I continued to work as long as I could. It was 93. Now, a lot of people had trouble getting their Social Security. The agent interviewed me over the phone and said, well, I'll put this through right away. You qualify. Very unusually, I was granted my Social Security right away without any trouble. No hassles whatsoever. I think if I'd have been in any other state at any other time, that would not have happened. I'd have had to fight. So the progress of the disease was that by 1996, my CD4 count was 19. That year, 96, they came out with the PI drugs. I had stopped taking AZT. Obviously, it wasn't working. But I had good results with the Norvir, and my doctor informed me that I had no detectable viral load. He said, don't worry about the CD4 count. He said, it's whether you have a viral load that is the standard of care now. But in 1996, there was a law that came out called the RISA law. It was a scheme the insurance companies put through, got Congress to put through, so that they didn't have to pay people like their long-term disability. So I went to school, and this friend I knew, I'd known him for about 4 years, and I didn't have the money to pay the rent where I was living. I asked if he would mind if he was living alone. He was approaching 70 at the time, I guess. And he welcomed me with open arms, and we had a pretty good time. But he died in my arms. I mean, I joined a religious order. I went there to die, and I said, well, can you bury me back here in the monastery? No. No, we own a mental health clinic downtown. You're so good with people, you're going to be our receptioner. So that's what I had to do for a while.
They knew your purpose?
Yeah, I guess. They thought I did so well. They wanted me to go back to take more courses at the hospital in clinical pastoral education. I swore to God after that first one, in 1974, that I would never, ever do this again. But I did. But this time it was in the hospital and not in a mental health clinic. I got the assignment of hospice chaplain. So I was dealing a lot with people's grief, their dying processes. And
so, and it's super interesting to me that several times you've said that, you know, you feel like you should not be alive, but you're surrounded by death throughout so many points along this journey.
Mm-hmm.
How does that line up for you mentally?
Well, that's an observation no one's ever made, but I think I was so familiar with it by then that I'm not afraid of death. Getting there, I'm afraid of, but I wasn't afraid of death itself. Still not. And I think, you know, the mission of hospice is to die with dignity, however that can be facilitated, and to not have pain. And so I saw most of the patients who came through there get that fulfilled pretty much. Death isn't anything for me to be afraid of. It's just I don't want to go through the mess. You know, I hate messes. I don't know who invented this, can I say, holiday of long-term survival of people who made it through. There are other people who had contracted HIV and lived longer than me with it, but I'm pretty long-lived for some reason. Don't know why. Don't know how, but here I am. One thing I can say is that I was faithful to all my regimens, medical regimens. Early on, I decided that the best thing I could do for me is to not stress. So I learned technique. I wouldn't do anything. Wouldn't put myself in a stressful situation if I could help it. That was the other thing. You have to change. When you become ill, you have to change somehow. And I was angry, I was very angry when I found out. I was angry at old people because they lived long. I was angry at young people because they were young. And I was just angry. But you have to change. You can't really... Anger is a good, valid human emotion. And there's really no control over anger, but it tells you something, gives you a lot of information. And I know that for me, when I get angry, it's telling me that there's an injustice. And that's what makes me angry. And so I think it's good for people to be in touch with their emotions, to listen to them. It gives them lots of information. Don't ignore them. Don't deny them. You don't have to act on them. But it's a good idea to listen to them and let them tell you what they're saying. I didn't learn that till much later in life, but anger can be good. Not hostility, not the belt. Hostility is never appropriate. I don't know. There we go. Live long and prosper, all of you.
Yeah, I mean, thanks so much. I mean, I've enjoyed this conversation, and it does feel like there are so many parallels the way that you describe between like current day and back in the 80s, what you lived firsthand, and it is just also it's just so crazy that like a lot of things haven't changed, as you said yourself, you know, like in terms of like responsiveness with the government and things along those lines. So it's just fascinating to hear. But as Adam said, this is the first in a series,
hopefully.
And yeah, we'll have more coming soon.
Yeah. Like, I've known you for years now, and knowing you more now, just like, I love you even more, and I really appreciate you sharing your story with us.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I have been a rover. I have walked alone. Hiked 100 highways. Never found a home. Still in all, I'm happy. reason is, you see, once in a while, along the way, love's been good to me.